This has been a retro episode, replaying some of my favorite interviews so far this year. Tonight you heard Geordie's departing artistic director, Mike Payette, Dean Patrick Fleming directing Every Brilliant Thing, and Yael Azoulay on The Art of the Jig. Thank you to my guests. Next week, September 9th, back with fresh conversations with Ida Holmes at the Centaur, Lisa Rubin at...
What's the matter? Is everything all right? That's okay. I've got just the right thing for you. KKUT 90.3
From the examples of Snowden and Assange, the manifesto of the current contemporary hacker scene has become privacy for the weak, transparency for the powerful. Privacy and transparency being too often overlooked, but really very fundamental conditions for a functioning democracy. Privacy guarantees autonomy and security in one's personal sphere and thoughts, and transparency is the only antidote to misguided or corrupt governance.
That's Maureen Webb, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Maureen Webb on hackers and democracy. The digital age has given birth to hackers who carry out cyber attacks on our personal data, on pipelines, energy grids, and meat processing factories. On the other hand, there are, can I say, good hackers who promote democracy by practicing the sharing of software, open sourcing, and securing the free flow of information. Maureen Webb, who has studied and written about these democracy hackers, says they are making some of the most important contributions to preserving our liberal democratic tradition in the 21st century. Confronted with concentrations of power, mass surveillance, and authoritarianism enabled by new technology, hackers are trying to build out democracy into cyberspace. They have been developing tools for civilian encryption and privacy. They've fought for transparency, a fact-based discourse, and accountability, all critical for democracy. Our guest today is Maureen Webb. She's a labor lawyer and human rights activist. She's taught national security law as an adjunct professor at the University of British Columbia. She's the author of Coding Democracy: How Hackers Are Disrupting Power, Surveillance, and Authoritarianism. She spoke in Vancouver, British Columbia, on March 31st, 2021. The moderator of the event is Professor Samir Gundesha, director of the Institute for the Humanities at Simon Fraser University. And now, Maureen Webb.
Coding Democracy reports on a phenomenon in the political landscape that many have been missing: the rapid spread of hacker culture and its potency to disrupt the concentrations of power, mass surveillance, and growing authoritarianism that have become the defining features of these first decades of the 21st century. And in this sense, hacking is a new kind of social activism, which is all about distributed power, distributed decision-making, and distributed democracy. Coding Democracy alludes to a hacker thesis that Larry Lessig of Harvard Law famously expounded on, the idea that code is law. That is, that in a world of ubiquitous computing, the self-executing nature of code will largely determine our relationships and rights, and even undermine constitutional guarantees if we don't pay attention to it. So the title suggests that computer code, more than law, is going to determine the kinds of societies we live in, whether they end up resembling democracies at all. But the title is also meant to place agency very much in the hands of people. The book it does not take a utopian or deterministic view of technology. So coding democracy also means, what do citizens need to set in place in the digital age to make democracies work? How can societies hold on to and build out democracy in the digital age? as a constitutional lawyer, I've been concerned about the erosion of democratic norms since 9/11. In 2007, I wrote this book, Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. It was published 6 years before the Snowden revelations about domestic and global spying in the U.S. And predicted much of what his leaks revealed about the scope of the surveillance and its dangers for democracy. As a lawyer, I kept thinking that our constitutions in the West would be strong enough to roll back abuses once they were uncovered. But as time went on, I began to realize that this was not going to happen. Looking at the pervasive illegality that states and corporations were engaged in their uses of digital tech, the inability of existing legal regimes to govern their activity, it was manifest that the law was collapsing. I came personally to grapple with the fact that code, more than law, was setting the norms we were now living by. The question occurred to me, who controls code? You know, really a struggle is taking place right now to build the coded environment around us. Ordinary users, computer users, and citizens are at the mercy of the code makers. And hackers are shamans in this space. I, of course, was familiar with the negative stereotype of hackers as dangerous nihilistic elements in society. And of course, there's that threat out there, and it's not to be minimized. But this is only part of the whole hacker story. I knew enough to believe that hackers might also be vital disruptors in the emerging digital environment with its dystopic, anti-democratic tendencies. In the balance of my time, I would like to dig down and try to tell you why I think hackers are making some of the most important intellectual and practical contributions to preserving our liberal democratic tradition today. But first, I would like to break this lecture up a bit and give you a short reading from the book. The reading that I've chosen pertains to the city of Berlin, a city which has many lessons to teach us about concentrations of power, surveillance, and authoritarianism the 20th century, and also a city through which many of the contemporary hacker stories have intersected. And the book begins with a reverie on the place and its relation to hacking. In Berlin. Berlin still has many bombed out lots. If you peer in behind the mesh fences, you see deep craters that sink precipitously under a cover of decades old trees. These holes seem to perforate the psyche as well as the landscape of the city. Some are the size of city blocks, some the size of small neighborhoods, and some are just green spaces where large tracts of city and inhabitants have ceased to exist as geographic facts. In photos of the post-war period, the Reichstag building is often visible, with Germans picking their way around its large, defeated hulk on foot and on bicycles, the road a track of mud. The seat of German democratic government in Berlin, the Reichstag was notoriously set on fire in 1933, then scorned by Adolf Hitler, he never used it, and badly bombed by Allied planes. The Germans left it unreconstructed until well into peacetime, living with its wreckage until it was finally patched up for use in the 1960s and fully renovated in the 1990s. The dome of the renovated Reichstag echoes the burned out, twisted dome of the old building and is encased in glass, a symbol perhaps of both contrition and transparency. Walking around the bomb sites, the broken wall, and the sooty, uncared for imperial buildings of Berlin, a visitor might wonder whether these two values, contrition and transparency, can exercise the dark history of the place, which in the 20th century went through multiple paroxysms, two wars of aggression, wild excess and inflation, mass deportations and murder, totalitarian surveillance, and a grim physical division. Despite a new German narrative of economic recovery and openness, Berliners still live amid the ruins of their elites' many bad decisions. They tend to be people with few illusions. It's no coincidence that a strong hacker culture has taken root here and flourished. All right, now I'm going to tell you why I think hackers are making some of the most important contributions to preserving our liberal democratic tradition in the 21st century. And I think a good place to start is to ask, what is the Western liberal democratic tradition? Liberal Democrats, Western liberal Democrats, might say that democracy involves at least three things. The first is the idea of popular sovereignty. Democracy means government is answerable to the people. Politically sovereign people are free people, and governments that consistently fail to carry out the wishes of the people, either because they are captured by class or corporate interests or because their technocrats take important issues off the table, are not democratic, but arguably tyrannical. Liberal Democrats might say that the second thing a democracy involves is mitigating the domination of some over others. At the very least, this means that the majority rules, but minorities are protected. Powerful interests are regulated and not allowed to run roughshod over the less powerful. And in the same vein, a belief in the equal dignity and worth of each individual is central to the concept of liberal democracy. Freedom must be enjoyed by all, not just by the strongest. And this is achieved through institutional means such as a Bill of Rights, the separation of powers, regulation, and social norms. And finally, Western liberal Democrats might say a democracy involves sharing a commonwealth. As US historian Gordon Wood has observed, republics demand more from their citizens than monarchies do. They are not held together by trains of dependencies and inequalities supported by standing armies, religious establishments, and a dazzling array of titles, rituals, and ceremonies. Rather, democracies are ordered on the virtue of their people. And one thing they demand of citizens is that they place a moral value on social cohesion and the common weal. So these constellations of ideas correspond roughly to the great organizing principles of the Enlightenment, liberté, égalité, and fraternité. And that tradition, I think we all know, is in trouble. Historically, democracy has been based on the nation state, and in maps of the digitally networked world, the nation state is looking increasingly irrelevant. Networks don't keep borders, and they intensify complexity. Often they intensify concentrations of power and value extraction. Even if nation states had the will, and in the neoliberal era they have not had this will, there may be little that they can do about these negative network dynamics. And indeed, network utopianism and neoliberalism, these two ideologies that have politically dominated the last few decades, would have us surrender ourselves to the power of networks, the tech, and the creative destruction of it all. But after 40 years of creative destruction, people are justifiably beginning to wake up and begin to question where surrender leads us, and they are rebelling. So for Democrats like myself, the current crisis in governance, which is so very obvious in the United States, but even in Canada, I think there are signs of it. This current crisis in governance is profoundly dismaying. We know that we need new theories of political economy to replace neoliberalism. And we know that we need new social experiments to discover them. We know we need to invent new ways of democratic being in the digital age. And this is exactly the project of the contemporary progressive hacker scene and the broader hacker movement. Let me give you a short history about how hacking has evolved to take on this project. Hacking didn't begin in Europe. It began in the United States at MIT in the 1950s around early mainframe computers with young programmers who developed an ethic that journalist Stephen Levy observed and summarized in his famous book, Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution. And broadly speaking, the central tenet of the hacker ethic is the hands-on imperative. This is the idea that one should be able to take systems apart, to study and interrogate them, to modify and repurpose them, and to share one's modifications. This hacker's ethos, with its hands-on imperative, had a profound influence on digital technology since the early days. Hackers were original innovators in Silicon Valley, and they've made an immense contribution in the development of free software. That is code that can be studied, questioned, built upon, repurposed, and shared. Free software is a philosophy and a practice. And free and open software have really become the backbone of the digital world. It runs on most of the internet servers, on most of the world's supercomputers, on the New York Stock Exchange, on the platforms of Google, Facebook, and Amazon, and those of many governments, and widely it's seen to be superior to code that is not produced with this philosophy and with commons-based production. Hackers were key players in the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement, and since the early 2000s, there's been this exponential growth of the progressive hacker scene, in which citizens and hackers have been working together to guarantee citizens' privacy, to bring transparency and accountability to those in power, to realize the social and economic goals of Occupy in the digital era, and to upgrade democratic processes themselves. And of course, two of the most momentous stories in the short history of hacking are those of Julian Assange and Edward Snowden. Assange's WikiLeaks, which published leaked information about states and oligarchs that ushered in an age of unprecedented transparency into global politics, and Edward Snowden, who revealed the extent to which the US is violating privacy around the world. And finally, in the last decade or two, there's been a fascinating mainstreaming and institutionalization of hacking and hacking experiments in places like Harvard, MIT, and Stanford, that underscores the rising significance of the phenomenon. This mainstreaming has garnered new respectability and resources for hacking experiments and has had both positive and negative effects. The ideas that hackers have been developing over the past three decades or so of privacy and transparency adapted to the digital age, of net neutrality, of free software and commons-based production, of trust busting adapted to the digital age and data self-determination, and the tools they've been developing to secure these could be as important to a new age of democracy as the great organizing principles, liberty, equality, and fraternity were to the Enlightenment era of democracy. We're talking about a serious systems upgrade here. So let me unpack these digital age democratic principles for you. First and second are the principles of privacy and transparency adapted to the digital age. Drawing from the examples of Snowden and Assange, the manifesto of the current contemporary hacker scene has become privacy for the weak, transparency for the powerful. Privacy and transparency being too often overlooked, but really very fundamental conditions for a functioning democracy. Privacy guarantees autonomy and security in one's personal sphere and thoughts, and transparency is the only antidote to misguided or corrupt governance. So where there has been the growth of surveillance capitalism and state social control through surveillance, big data, and algorithms, hackers have been developing tools for civilian encryption and privacy. Where there has been information wars that have nearly overwhelmed our democratic election processes in the West, hackers have fought for transparency and a fact-based discourse. The third principle that I'd like to summarize for you is the principle of net neutrality. And net neutrality is something that ordinary users take for granted because it's built into the net, it was built into the net when it was created. And it has a number of dimensions. The net was neutral in that the basic protocol that created it did not do anything but send information between servers. It was a decentralized network of networks with a default mode of interoperability. And this meant that it did not monitor or discriminate against content or users. Anyone could participate, move around it freely, speak and associate freely, and use it for their own purposes. In short, there were no gatekeepers. And the important thing to understand about hackers' fight for net neutrality is that it is really a fight for free communication. As hackers would underline, in the digital era, if you expect to decide freely what you want to listen to, watch, receive, send, publish, create, and even think as a citizen, net neutrality is essential. Net neutrality is also about the future of media, which media outlets survive, what stories get told, and which are suppressed. It's a fight about innovation and free markets, because in an information economy, we depend on unfettered access to the internet. And it's a fight about political freedom, because political speech and organizing take place increasingly through the internet. So where there has been commercialization and sequestering of the internet and the introduction of censorship and gatekeeping, hackers have tried to ensure net neutrality, decentralization, and interoperability. The fourth principle, hacker principle, or digital era democratic principle that I'd like to describe for you is this principle of free software. And I'll expound on that a little, having mentioned it just a moment ago. You know, hackers have been proselytizing the value of free software for a long time. And this is, again, software that can be scrutinized, modified, built upon, and shared without restriction. And free software, people are fond of saying, isn't the same as free beer. It's it doesn't mean that hackers can't charge money for their services or for their initial creation or modification of software if someone is willing to pay. But it does mean that once free software is released, there are no restrictions on it. That means that once you acquire free software, it is in your control. You can fix it, adapt it, study it, pass it on, reproduce it, improve upon it. It's in your control. And this idea that code should be in the control of computer users is a bedrock principle of freedom and democracy in the digital age that many ordinary citizens just do not understand and maybe never even heard of. Many companies want to prevent this. They don't want users to be able to study their code. They want to keep it in a kind of perpetual black box. They don't want users to own the code that they paid for, but to become perpetual renters of the code. This is more profitable. They don't want users to be able to fix the code in the things they buy from fridges to giant tractors, because this is another opportunity for profit. And what is known as digital restrictions management regimes that put locks on code and make it a criminal offense to tamper with those locks really deprive computer users of control over their computing and of their property rights. And hackers have argued turn us all into serfs of those corporations. So where there is proprietary closed code and a huge shift of property rights to software owners through digital rights management locks and related laws, hackers have fought for an end to DRM practices. And they have also, time and time again, proven the superior quality of free software, which is made through commons-based production, because it can be studied, questioned, built upon, repurposed, and shared. And that's what's made it so valuable. That's what has led to it becoming really the backbone of the digital world, as I described earlier. The fifth and sixth principles for a digital era democracy that need to be noted are the principle of antitrust adapted to the digital age and data self-determination. And just suffice for me to say here that where platform monopolies are killing local economies, hackers are innovating ways to break these up through alternative, these monopolies up through alternative platforms and business models that we could build a new economy around. And where companies are colonizing humanity's data, hackers are innovating ways to ensure data self-determination. So that summary barely does justice to these hacker ideas and their genealogy. But I deal at length with them in the book, along with other ideas, as well as the urgent need for citizens to have a new kind of civics education, a digital era civics education, so that citizens can see the world that is rapidly changing around them as clearly as technologists and hackers see it. Because I think that the only way that citizens will be able to begin to move their resources in directions that might preserve their democracies is to understand what is the transformations that are really occurring because of the this transformative technology, digital technology that is so radically changing our societies. In pursuit of a democracy upgrade for the digital era, hackers are building all kinds of things. And as I suggested at the outset, there are hacker experiments underway right now that I believe could fundamentally transform the current political economy. The stories I could tell you are legion, but even a small selection demonstrates the effervescence of the historical moment. Many experiments are using the federated tech of the existing internet. And this is the basic protocol that links the internet together as an interoperable, decentralized network of networks. At the most ambitious level, hackers are working on the creation of a whole new civilian internet that is privacy secure and provides self-determination over data, net neutrality, and interoperability as design features. The Chaos Computer Club has been working on this project since at least 2015, and the EU has a new initiative called the Next Generation Internet, which they've promised will be a human-centric internet. And the Chaos Computer Club is advising them on that. That will be a large societal project. It, you know, potentially could put Europe at an advantage to other societies in that it will give them an edge in the digital economy to have a really fully secure civilian internet that is designed to embody democratic values. And, you know, frankly, I think that it's more likely that the EU will succeed in building something like this. It's a very large societal project rather than individual hacker groups, but a lot of the ideas are being taken from hacker groups. And finally, Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, has a new project for a new re-decentralized web. Of course, he built the web as a decentralized technology, but it has over time become more and more centralized. He calls his project Solid. Hackers are building a plethora of leaking platforms like WikiLeaks. They have, and this is to hold governments and oligarchs accountable. They have an almost a comedic number of names: Global Leaks, Balta Leaks, Quebec Leaks, Murdoch Leaks. There's dozens and dozens. Hackers are creating cooperative platforms that allow people to exchange value outside of the platform monopolies presently killing much of our economies. These are both for work and for social ends. And maybe the ultimate hack will be having some of the large platform monopolies that exist today being regulated as utilities. Because, you know, code can be replicated at near zero cost. So why should a handful of individuals seize the immense wealth and bounty of these platforms? Hackers are creating alternative clouds, alternative data commons, that's shared data for civic or health purposes that are user or citizen controlled. They're creating alternative media platforms. There's hacker alternatives to Twitter, to Facebook, to Spotify, all with a range of success or failure, but the attempts are being made.
You're listening to Maureen Webb on Hackers and Democracy. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get CDs of this program and her book, Coding Democracy, How Hackers Are Disrupting Power, Surveillance, and Authoritarianism, by calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online to our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, or MP3s of this program at no charge. Just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977.
So those are the federated tech experiments. Other hacker experiments are using peer-to-peer and blockchain technology. And these two technologies are really in the early stages of development. So some of the experiments sound a little pie in the sky, but many are likely to be realized. And if and when they are, they have enormous potential for radically changing the political economy. Just to describe these briefly to you, because this is something that's important to understand in grasping the potentialities of some of the experiments that hackers are undertaking. Peer-to-peer networks do not use central servers like federated networks do. Instead, they use ordinary computers to process data and to deliver it to other computers without an intermediary. So, you know, within a peer-to-peer network, there may be hundreds or thousands of computers. These are used together. Their computing power is harnessed by the peer-to-peer technology to send information and to do the computer processing. Peer-to-peer allows one-to-one exchange of value and the creation of virtual supercomputers, as I've just described, without centralized intermediaries, whether these be government, platform monopoly, legacy institution intermediaries like the stock exchange or fiat money systems. But peer-to-peer can't guarantee trust. You have to trust your peers in a peer-to-peer network, and because there's no central authority to intervene and enforce standards. And it's blockchain that solves the problem of trust in peer-to-peer by creating a permanent tamper-proof public ledger of transactions that is then distributed across the many computers in the peer-to-peer system. So blockchain is essentially a ledger that records transactions using mathematics. Equations. It helps to think of it as a chain that's being forged one link at a time, where each link is a mathematical equation that links to the next. And so it can't be excised from the chain or modified after it's created. The blockchain is revolutionary in that it automates trust. You don't have to trust a central provider of a service, and you don't have to trust the people you are dealing with. You only have to trust the code, which allows your transaction to be processed using mathematical formulas that verify its authenticity and then to be recorded on a public ledger, stored and distributed across many computers in the network. And hackers are using, they're showing us how peer-to-peer and blockchain technology could potentially allow us to create self-executing contracts and whole communities of trust that could replace corrupt legacy institutions. So for example, peer-to-peer and blockchain could allow the creation of virtual supercomputers, harnessing the power of many individual computers, powerful enough to run large ventures such as alternative stock exchanges, alternative banking systems, or money systems that would rival the rigged systems we have today. And with these two technologies, hackers are also creating prototypes for innovative micropayment systems that could pay users for their attention or effectively tax financial transactions and corporations like Amazon, Google, and Apple that would increase the flow of money through local economies by distributing the bounty of technological advances more fairly. Hackers are engaged right now in experiments that could revolutionize democratic processes and decision-making itself. And in the second part of the book, and this is really my favorite part because I got to meet some amazing people, I look at the experiments that are out there hacking democratic processes and decision-making. And I I traveled to Italy, where the Cinque Stelle movement is using a hacker platform to effect a mixture of direct, participatory, and representative democracy. And I spoke to a couple of MPs there in their 40s who were just elected to parliament. And they told me about their hacker-inspired politics and the particular hacker-made platform that the movement uses to effect this direct, participatory, and representative democracy. I traveled to Spain, where the hacker collective XNet are using a hacker-created leaking platform called Global Leaks and participation of the community. They used it and they forced prosecutors to bring nearly 100 bankers and politicians to trial for their role in the country's financial crisis of 2008. And finally, I spoke to a colleague that I know through the civil liberties community in British Columbia, and many of you might know, John Richardson, who is developing a new startup called Ethelo. He says that large groups can be very smart, smarter than the smartest experts. And he asks, how do we increase intelligence by adding more people to the decision-making process? So he's working on an algorithm that could distribute influence, minimize resistance, and optimize buy-in for difficult policy choices. And even generate a range of policy choices in order of their likelihood of being supported by a group. And they have actually sold this technology or serviced the Canadian government using this technology. And there's been words of praise from, I don't know, the Department of Procurement or something like that. And I said to John, what happens if you corner the decision-making market? You know, you become the next big platform monopoly for decision making. And he said, without a beat, global democracy. And what he meant was not that, you know, he would have some monopoly like Google oppressing everyone, but rather what he envisions is that it would be a totally open source common operating system with a pluralism of smaller systems plugged into it, so that really it would work the way that Linux has become the go-to operating, the kernel or operating system for much of the digital world. There's actually many similar experiments around the world, like Ethelo, where hackers and hacking citizens are working to affect distributed democracy. And they have names like Wikigovernance, Lumio, Democracy Earth Blockchain, and Council is a new one in Madrid. Now, of course, as our generation of activists from the revolutions in 1968 will know, direct democracy, participatory democracy, self-organization, shared leadership, and direct action are not new ideas. What hackers are doing is showing us what can be achieved to upgrade the quality of Western liberal democracies with these and related ideas, employing digital tech, networks, and a hacking ethic. And to the extent that they succeed, I think we'll be able to realize new levels of distributed power in our democratic governance structures. And I think that the citizens who used their votes for Brexit and Donald Trump in the last half of 2016, felt they didn't have much more than these wrecking balls to change and finally demolish the old political economy. But if Western liberal democracies can be upgraded in the 21st century, citizens might have more to work with. So the new political economy has yet to be fully created, let alone theorized. Marx was a brilliant theorist who told us a lot about industrial production and industrial era capitalism. His ideas are not wholly sufficient for explaining digital era production. Both technological and philosophical innovations will be needed. But what you see in the hacking experiments of the last decade is a first cut at the project. And I think it's just fascinating that this is all happening at a time when people's faith in elites to govern has never been lower, and when reform through traditional mechanisms seems out of sight. I see it as a new form of populism, a digital populism, And just like the prairie populism that innovated universal health care in Canada during the early decades of the 20th century and produced a blueprint for replacing corrupt economic institutions in the US during the progressive era, this digital populism is a good development, not an ominous one. So thanks very much. That's the end of my lecture, and I'll turn it over to Samir.
Thanks very much, Maureen. I would like to use my prerogative as chair and moderator here to get the question period up and running. And I think that the place that I'd want to begin really is with Julian Assange. I want to focus on Assange a little bit because on the one hand, I mean, he really is somebody who starts out by focusing on privacy for the weak to some extent, but certainly transparency for the powerful. But he ends up in his dump of the Democratic Party emails of Hillary Clinton, and in particular, the ones between her and Podesta, the chair of her campaign in 2016. But this inadvertently has the effect of supporting the Trump side. It really does seem to give Trump a huge boost going into that last week before the election. I think just in that moment, there's a kind of ambivalence in the figure of the hacker that I'm not sure is explored as much as it could be. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about a certain kind of ambivalence in the democratic credentials, as it were, of the hacker, because they do have a kind of knowledge that lay people like us don't. They might be committed to democracy. However, that might be a kind of ambivalent commitment.
There's a lot to say there. It's not that law is no longer has any force or relevance. It's that it has to support whatever the code is doing, right? So that it's sort of secondary. The code has a very strong normative force, and you have to figure out how to use law to nudge and contain or enable the normative force of code. So I do acknowledge that hackers, you know, are engaged in a whole range of acts, from the plainly dangerous and nihilistic to the highly altruistic. And that each of these acts raises difficult policy questions that will need to be dealt with by societies, one issue at a time. So, for example, should the various hacker acts be viewed as incidents of public service, free speech, legitimate protest, civil disobedience, pranksterism, or should they be treated as trespass, tortious interference, intellectual property infringement, theft, fraud, conspiracy, extortion, espionage, terrorism, or even treason? How society treats hackers over time will certainly be part of the dialectic of where we end up. So the law does have a role to play. On a figure like Assange, I mean, I think he's kind of an anti-hero, isn't he? He's made an amazing contribution to democratic governance in showing the kind of transparency that is possible in the digital era. And yet we still are left with the societal question of how do we balance freedom of the press with the need for a certain amount of privacy for institutions to operate, secrecy for institutions to operate optimally. And that's a question we haven't answered yet. But I do think that whatever you think about it, Assange, and at the last camp that I was at in Germany, the hackers themselves were extremely negative about him. It was a little dismaying to see them not grasp the principle at stake, which is freedom of the press. And in the United States, that is far from settled in law. Since the Pentagon Papers, there's been before and after the Pentagon Papers, there was sort of a tradition rather than a clear legal principle that governments would not prosecute or insist on revealing their sources, as long as journalists would vet their stories in advance with government. And the court in the Pentagon Papers case held that it would not interfere lightly with freedom of the press. but it's not yet been fully defined, and it's in grave danger. And the Assange case will be the bellwether of that. So, and then in terms of their politics, well, the early cypherpunks in the United States were rabid libertarians, but then they created a list that became this international list for hackers. And, you know, there was everything from Wobblies to Maoists on that list. And something that Harry Halpin, a guy that worked for Tim Berners-Lee, who I met in Germany, an American, pointed out to me, is that the internet and digital tech was created with an ethos of decentralization, openness, and human rights, and that most tech people generally believe in those things. So that even, you know, the big monopolies give money to organizations like the Electronic Frontier and the Free Software Foundation. The belief in the market might be stronger, but the DNA of digital tech is rooted in these hacker ethics and these hacker ideas of decentralization, distributed power, and freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of association. He says that, you know, deep down, most technologists you meet believe in a rights-based kind of a framework.
Thank you very much for those responses. Let's go to the questions. What are the most successful or promising hacker initiatives that substantially challenge the power of big tech platforms, Google and Facebook in particular? What are the major obstacles they face in these initiatives?
Well, that's almost like an essay question. The first thing that came to my mind, Andrew, one of your own initiatives, which is IX Maps, I think it's called, where Andrew and his colleagues are mapping where the physical infrastructure of the internet is, so that we can understand when we send an email that, you know, could just be down the street from the University of Toronto to a colleague who lives nearby, that sometimes it goes straight there, but sometimes it goes all the way down to Milwaukee or some other big switching station in the infinite internet structure, and how kind of arbitrary that structure is, how it's been built as a patchwork over time. It started often with public efforts that were then taken over by private interests. So now we have a largely private infrastructure. And so we don't know, for the most part, where our data is even going. We haven't even mapped it. And that was really important during the post 9/11 years, where if your data goes down to the United States, it's subject to the USA Patriot Act. So there's a beautiful example of a hacker project. And obviously it has some, you know, big challenges, because how do you map something as complex as that patchwork that is the physical infrastructure of the internet?
How can liberal digital democracy initiatives safeguard against state-directed hackers of foreign powers?
Yeah, that's getting into the cyber war area, which is not an area of my expertise. I do say some things about Russian troll farms and the approach to disinformation and information dysphoria of the Putin regime. We're not only on a new frontier, the electronic frontier. We are, I don't know, we're in this multidimensional space right now. And when quantum computing comes on, there's no saying what's going to happen. So, you know, I think when you mentioned how when Julian Assange drops a giant leak of information, it has an inordinate impact beyond anything we would have imagined in the analog world. But when computing becomes as powerful as quantum computing, and we have essentially an arms race, I mean, there's a struggle to build the coded world around us. You know, it's foreign actors, it's our own governments, it's private companies. And the hackers are almost these hobbyists who do this altruistic work in their spare time to try to help citizens and affect their own ideals in the world. But the odds are enormous. That's what I would say about the whole landscape with cyber warfare putting that into context.
One of the issues that worry us non-experts is the tendency for democracy to be equated with anyone being able to say anything about anything, leading to the phenomenon of internet bullying, as well as undermining any sense of knowledge as requiring discipline and effort. You began to speak about coding strategies to address these issues, and I wonder if you could say more about this in the context of radical social alternatives.
There's a lot of discussion right now about whether we should be looking for tech solutions to the problem of truly false news, and more generally, information dysphoria, where you have micro-targeted political advertising, for example, that like Cambridge Analytica did in the UK before the Brexit vote and in the United States. I think that, you know, that there's lots of work to be done still to gauge the impact of the technology in influencing people. But I feel very strongly as a liberal Democrat that we ought not to go down the route of censorship. I think that's a betrayal of liberal democratic ideals. And I think that there are other solutions that we can look to. More tech solutions are going to end up being opaque. They're going to end up being in the hands of platform monopolists in the private sector. And why would we hand them that very important role in society? And they're just going to come with their own set of issues. I think for some problems, the solution is outside of tech. And I would agree with a scholar like Timothy Snyder, who talks about tyranny and authoritarianism. And one of the points that he makes is that we maybe used our digital technology too much for political discourse, for political connection, for social connection. We need to get off these devices and we need to run for government. We need to volunteer in our local community centers. We need to talk to people that disagree with us politically. I think this is one of the things that's happening in the pandemic, of course, is exacerbating it, that we don't talk to each other anymore. We do not talk to people that have different points of view, political points of view and experiences from ourselves. And so our views are never tempered. And then they are radicalized even more by the technology. So there's some responsibility on the part of citizens. I don't think we can put it all on tech.
There were many people who would consider themselves to be on the left who cheered Twitter when it blocked Donald Trump. Without any sense of, well, hold on here, what are the implications of this, that this might actually affect us? So that's very troubling. Greg Gerber, you spoke about blockchain as a disruptor. Can you comment on the disruptive applications we might expect? For example, crypto payments and blockchain mediated voting systems, medical passports, and other applications. We see governments working to regulate and limit the autonomy of blockchain. How might we mitigate the loss of trust in these technologies as a result of centralization?
It's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, because it's used with peer-to-peer technology, and so it allows people to make transactions one-to-one without an intermediary. So that means that you could make payments without involving banks or fiat money systems, and that could be done for criminal purposes, or it could be done to avoid the existing legacy systems that are rigged against the ordinary citizen. You could do property transactions in a country that has a failed state or recurring failed governments and a very poor record of property, and that could be very beneficial. You could, buy and sell things outside of the monopoly platforms. Once you start thinking about blockchain in sort of ideal, optimal uses, it's just mind-blowing because, you can do almost anything doing an end run around the big corporation or the bad government or the rotten legacy institution. However, on the other hand, blockchain could become this really maniacally bad instrument of surveillance because it creates this permanent, unalterable ledger. It could be that anything that you do could never be denied. It would be recorded forever in history that you went to this website or you transacted, let's say, in a cashless society. You couldn't do anything financial without the government surveilling you. I do recognize that none of this is simple. And I don't put anything forward as purely utopian. I'm just saying that we need a new political economy. It's already being built around us. It looks really authoritarian and unequal and intrusive. How can we envision something different, and how can we trip the change that needs to happen?
That was Maureen Webb on Hackers and Democracy. She spoke in Vancouver, British Columbia on March 31st, 2021. Maureen Webb is a labor lawyer and human rights activist. She's the author of Coding Democracy: How Hackers Are Disrupting Power, Surveillance, and Authoritarianism. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 35th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, Maureen Webb on Hackers and Democracy, and for her book, Coding Democracy: How Hackers Are Disrupting Power, Surveillance, and Authoritarianism, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Samir Gundesha. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
The Association des Services de Réhabilitation Sociale du Québec is filing a class action suit. If you were strip searched between July 13th, 2006 and July 1st, 2011, if you were in one of the following facilities, Bordeaux, Rivière-des-Prairies, Roberval, Saint-Jérôme, or the male sector of Quebec City, you may be able to be part of this claim. For complete details, go to asrsq.ca/class action. That's asrsq.ca/class action. Claims must be filed before January 16th, 2022.
Sarah's excited to celebrate her birthday at a restaurant. She's thought about it all week. She invited her friends. She got a new dress. She went to the restaurant. She wasn't allowed in the restaurant. She had to put away her new dress. She couldn't see her friends. And she thought about it all week.
Don't wait until it hits you. Get vaccinated. A vaccination passport is now required to enter certain public spaces. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Laurie a hâte de célébrer son anniversaire au resto. Elle y a pensé toute la semaine. Elle a invité ses amis. Elle a acheté une nouvelle robe. Elle s'est rendue au resto. Elle n'a pas pu rentrer dans le resto. Elle a dû ranger sa nouvelle robe. Elle n'a pas pu voir ses amis. Et elle y a pensé toute la semaine.
N'attendez pas de frapper un mur. Faites-vous vacciner. Le passeport vaccinal est maintenant exigé pour fréquenter certains lieux publics. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Make sure my levels are at around 8.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Blah, blah, blah.
It's kind of a tongue twister.
Am I popping my peas?
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Start again.
Oh, should I do that? Okay.
I need a script. CKUT 90.3 FM.
So you want me to go through it again and actually say that?
This sounds so repetitive.
See, now I can't do it. Once more. Okay.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait, do you want me to say hello?
I'll have to do another one.
Yeah, maybe one last one.
Radio CKUT 90.3 FM.
Are you recording? You are? Oh. Can you press stop?
Welcome to Pirate Block Radio. You're tuned into CKUT 90.3 FM with me, your host, Malte Leander. As you can tell from the room that I'm sitting in, I'm not in my usual space, but doing this month's episode on the road. Today's episode is a wrap-up of Eastern Bloc's digital festival Sight and Sound that has been running all throughout this summer. So what better way to trace back the steps than to speak to a few of the artists part of this year's program? I'm having Anna Eiler with me, who, together with her collaborator Nicolas Lapointe, has had their work Hell presented. That is Hell spelled with a number 3 instead of the E, a work which is a web browser-based interactive experience based upon the mythology revolving around the Styx. So welcome, Anna, to the show. Happy to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me, Malte. I'm excited to talk about this project. It's nice to have had a bit of time to reflect back on it. It was made early in 2021, so now I've got a bit of critical distance.
Great. That's always good. Well, so since we're focusing a bit on the